Good morning. So last time we introduced this idea of pipelining. We said that, well, in our current processor design, the single cycle one we were starting with, we had lots of components that did work during the execution of an instruction, and probably they were only really doing that work during part of that execution. Like, we needed to fetch the actual value of the instruction before most of the other machinery could work. That fetch takes a certain amount of time, and during the rest of the clock cycle, that circuitry that does the fetching, well, isn't doing very much. And we argue similar things about, say, our register file reading circuitry and our ALU circuitry that does addition, XOR, and so on. All this stuff was only working during part of that clock cycle and otherwise was basically unused. And our kind of solution for this is this idea we call pipelining. It's kind of an assembly line style where we say we're going to fetch one instruction, then we're going to fetch the next instruction, even though we haven't finished executing the first instruction. And that's okay, because we'll store the instruction we fetched in registers we're going to add, and we'll just keep going ahead. And so we'll do stage two of that first instruction, which would be register read in our standard design, while we're fetching the next instruction. We'll keep doing this over and over again. So we divide our processor into these stages. Instructions go through one stage at a time, and the instruction following them in the program follows them afterwards. We sort of gave the analogy with laundry, where we said, oh, when you're doing laundry, if you have a washer and a dryer, you don't just put something in the washer, move it to the dryer, and only then go on to your next load of laundry. We're going to have the same idea for instructions. We don't fetch the first instruction, read the registers for the instruction, execute the instruction, write back the results, and then go on to the next instruction. We're going to do it earlier, at least when we can. And I wrote something wrong here. And we talked about, in measuring the impact of this, the idea of latency versus throughput. So latency is the time from start to finish. That's our sort of naive measure of how fast is an instruction. And we learned that pipelining makes things slower in terms of latency, but makes things faster in terms of throughput, the rate at which we finish instructions. That's actually faster, because we're doing multiple at a time, and throughput's the measure we actually care about. I mentioned when we were doing pipelining with circuits, we worked by adding registers between the stages. We need to do this because even though we said, oh, that machinery that fetches an instruction value, fetches this machine code, isn't actually doing anything during the rest of the cycle, it's not entirely true. It's kind of holding the value that it fetched stable so the rest of the circuit can use it. So we need something to replace that functionality. We need some place to store those results while it's working on the next thing. So we add some registers to do that, and we do this between every pair of stages in our processor. And we talked about, well, how much can we actually do with this? And we said, well, there's going to be a limit to how many stages we can add usefully. And the big reason why this is going to be a limitation is that whichever stage we have, which is slowest, that's going to determine our performance. And it's going to also turn out that we can't just divide up the work evenly in practice. We can't take an addition operation and divide it exactly in half. That's not going to be practical. We're going to have some loss there. And, some part's going to take longer, and that part's going to determine our performance, not the faster part. Also, we learned that registers aren't free. They take some amount of time. We kind of had the model so far that they instantaneously store at that rising edge of a clock, but that's not actually physically possible, so they need some amount of time to work. So adding more registers is going to make our circuit slow. Okay, so questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so last time we were talking about this add queue processor. We mentioned our timeline here, that here I'm just have the values in each register at particular times, each of the pipeline registers. And we can see that instruction sort of go through over time from one stage to the next. So we have values from that instruction being passed through. And when things get full, like in cycle four here, we have, you know, each set of registers has values from distinct instructions. In this case, we have four stages. And so we have four sets of registers with values from four different instructions once things get going. So that's the operation of a pipeline. And we'd like to measure the performance of a pipeline. And I kind of talked about, oh, it takes a certain amount of time. And we want to talk about that maybe a little more formally. And I mentioned that, oh, the slowest stage determines the performance. And a way we can think about this is that having this notion of what we call a critical path, that there's a path from where we start at the beginning of a clock cycle, which is generally like a register whose value is going to change at the beginning of a clock cycle, that is at the rising edge, to where we have to store values that will be stored at the next rising edge of the clock cycle. And we have to go through that path within one clock cycle. So to determine how fast we can set our clock cycle, we look at all the possible paths and we say, can I do this in a clock cycle? And I need to set my clock cycle large enough for the slowest possible path. So we'll call that slowest path the critical path. It's going to be the one that determines the cycle time. And note that we have to choose to have one clock cycle length. Yes, it might be possible to make a processor which varies the clock speed based on what instructions you're executing, but that has lots of practical complications. So in practice, we're going to choose a single cycle speed for our processor, and that's going to be our cycle speed no matter which instructions we're running. And we can apply this principle for computing the cycle time both with and without pipeline. So we'll start without. So here's our big single cycle processor. And we can consider sort of various paths through the circuit. So for example, within a cycle, we need to be able to get the value from the PC through the adder that does the PC increment and back into the PC register through that mux there. And let's say we measure that out and we say that takes 25 picoseconds. That would be one thing, path to consider. We could measure, oh, it has to go through the instruction memory and through the circuitry that computes the instruction length. We want to measure that to be 50 picoseconds. And we keep doing this process. We just look at all the ways we can go through the circuit from sort of something that happens at the beginning of a cycle to something that happens at an end. And we get this giant list of timings. And we have lots of paths. And we just look at that list and we take the longest one, and that would determine what our cycle time would be. So in this case, assuming that 900 ends up being the longest time we measure, we'd say, we're going to set our cycle time to 900 picoseconds. And we're going to do that even though you might say, well, don't some instructions like not use the data memory so they could be faster? Well, yes, but it's generally not going to be practical to make circuitry that like changes the cycle time when we detect one of those instructions. So we're going to just choose one based on the worst case. And we can apply this to our simpler circuit. So in here, I can actually sort of enumerate, here's all the paths from something that happens at the start of a cycle to something that happens in the end. And the start of a cycle, like the big thing that happens in our single cycle processor is the PC changes, and that kind of triggers everything else to change. That's why all my paths start there. So questions about sort of examining our potential paths for this single cycle example? So when we move to our pipeline processor, we're going to have paths that are going from our pipeline registers and our PC to other storage elements, including pipeline registers and like the register file. So I have more paths to consider because I have going from the PC back to the PC. I have going from the PC through the instruction memory to the pipeline registers between fetch and decode, because that's what needs to happen in the cycle and fetch. The fetch stage, we have to go from the PC to the fetch decode registers. In the decode stage, I need to go from the fetch decode registers to the decode execute registers. In the execute stage, I need to go from the execute sorry, to code execute registers to the execute writeback registers and so on. So we look at the paths between usually pipeline registers, and those are my candidates, and I just time out how much time all of these need, and I say, okay, you know, I look for the longest one. In this case, I found out the longest one was path 2 and 3, these ones through the instruction memory, so our cycle time is going to be 210 picoseconds. So effectively what happened here is that our slowest stage was the fetch one, and that ended up determining our overall cycle time. But the way I would find this out is I just look at all the possibilities here. And I guess something to note, which is probably the biggest point of confusion here, is that in our fetch stage, we have this add to circuit, and we have this instruction memory. And for performance, for our cycle time, the path that mattered was the one through the instruction memory into our second pipeline registers here. It didn't matter how long it took to add to. And that's just because the add to was faster than the instruction memory, so it wasn't what was determining how long the stage needed. And the processor is ending up doing both of these operations in parallel, just kind of naturally. They're both happening at the same time for the same instruction. There's questions about our critical paths? Yes. What? What's the green path? This one here. So this is getting the program counter value, adding 2 to it, and getting it ready for the next cycle as the new program counter. So that's the green path. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes, I probably should think of some more colorblind friendly way of talking about the paths. Okay. So another way we might analyze this is we might say, okay, so if we look at this processor, we can like have a list of here are the components I gave you, here's how long they took, and we can say, oh, without pipelining, if we didn't have these pipeline registers, we'd have to go through the instruction memory, through the register file read circuitry, through the adder, and through the register file write. So I just add up all these times, that would be our longest path, that would be our cycle time. And that gets us 550 picoseconds. Note that that longest path didn't include this add to, because it could happen at the same time as we're reading from the memory, and in fact will. So it doesn't actually figure into this calculation, just because when I draw the longest path I have to worry about, it doesn't include the add to. If we're doing pipelining, we're going to do that analysis for each stage. So it's the slowest path through stage, which happens to be through the instruction memory. So at these times, our instruction memory is 200 picoseconds, so it's 200 picoseconds plus register delay. It doesn't matter that all the other stages are a lot faster. That's how fast it's going to be. And this means that to execute an instruction from beginning to end, we're going to have to spend 800 picoseconds, because that's 4 cycles plus the register delays 4 times. Some questions? So let's do one short exercise. So here I have 3 instructions that could be executed by this add processor. And my question is, when instruction 1 stores its result in RBX, it's just done that, what did instruction 3 just do? This is not on critical paths, but fine. Just reviewing our understanding of how this processor actually works. Who'd like some more time? I guess I should have asked this before I talked about critical paths. Which I'll do in the next lecture. Okay, who'd still like some more time? Okay, some people. So, and I guess I've written out a hint as one way of sort of going about this, just making a chart about what instruction is where, when. Sorry, is the cycle question, is the cycle always going to be 200 picoseconds? Yes. Because we have to set, well, 200 picoseconds plus a register delay in this case. We have to set a single cycle time. It's generally not going to be practical for us to change the cycle time depending what we're doing, what instruction we're executing. So even if we weren't using the fetch stage, hypothetically, we probably still have picoseconds. It's not that it's impossible to have the cycle time vary, it's just that it's very rare to see processors actually devote the lots of effort to do that on an instruction by instruction basis. That's very complicated to do. Okay, so let's see who thinks A. So instruction three, just B. Okay, C. D, E, okay, so we have pretty good consensus on B, I agree with. So one way I could figure this out is I said, we could say instruction one just completed write back, which is here in our diagram. So instruction two must have been just behind it in execute. Therefore instruction three was just behind instruction two in the register file read. That's the way I could figure it out. So it just completed write back, we must have just completed register file read for instruction three. Another way I could figure it out is I could write out what happens in each time. So let's say during cycle number zero, I fetch instruction one. That means during cycle number one, instruction one is going to move to decode, and we're going to fetch instruction two. During cycle number two, instruction one is going to move to execute, and we're going to decode instruction number two, and we're going to fetch instruction number three. Then instruction number one is going to move to write back during cycle number three. Instruction number two is going to move to execute. Instruction number three is going to move to decode. And we find out the same information that when we're doing the write back, finishing the write back for instruction one, we're finishing the decode for instruction three. Okay, some questions, how to figure this out? So, mentioned earlier that in this design with these timings here, our cycle time is 200 picoseconds plus some register delay time. So let's say I combine the add and register file read together. So what I'm doing is I'm saying, rather than having a separate stage for the decode and the execute, we're going to combine them together, so we're going to get rid of these pipeline registers here. My question is, what is the new cycle time? So I've removed a pipeline stage, got rid of a set of pipeline registers in the process. Now it's a three-stage pipeline instead of four. What's my new cycle time? Who would like some more time? Oh, that'd be okay. So who thinks A? B? Okay, I guess we have pretty good consensus on B. Then, that's, I guess. So what's my calculation here? So to save some time, I can realize, wait a moment, I only changed two stages. And my change could only make those two stages longer. Right, because before, without the, while the registers were there, they'd have shorter critical paths. Now I've made those paths potentially longer because previously I'd have some paths that would like end at these registers I just removed, and now they keep going. And so that's the paths I should be concerned about, whether that increases things. And if I look at this, this is a register file read and an add. So this path here and the similar paths are 235 picoseconds. 225 picoseconds, sorry. And remember, we want the longest path, and we know from our prior cycle time, the prior longest path before we made the change was 200 picoseconds. This is longer. It's the longer one's going to take precedence. We have to make the cycle time as long as it needs to be for the longest path. And so that's what we end up with our as our new cycle time. Questions how I figured that out? Okay, so it looks like we're kind of comfortable. This, or maybe I'm just asking the wrong exercises, but we'll find out, I guess, in the quiz. Okay, so we've talked about sort of pipeline performance a bunch and finally determining the cycle time, which is, you know, we kind of need to know about because there's no point in doing pipelining if we aren't changing our cycle time. Now, if we just keep our cycle time the same as it was in the single cycle processor, we're just making it like four or five times as slow. But let's talk about implementing the pipeline in actual HGLRS. So first, we're going to have some naming convention. So the way our textbook names the registers that we add for pipelining has a convention that we use the name of the stage that the register input or output comes from or goes to name the signals for the register. So for example, here I have, I'll do that. Here I have fetch, decode, execute, and write back. So my registers between fetch and decode will be lowercase f for fetch to uppercase d for decode. And we'll have this convention that the inputs from the fetch stage will start with a lowercase f, and the outputs that go into the decode stage will start with an uppercase d. Similarly, the inputs from the decode stage will start with a lowercase d, and the outputs that go to the execute stage will start with an uppercase E. So the name, so an HGLRS will declare the decode to execute registers with lowercase d, capital E. And in this case, we don't have a memory stage, so we have registers that go directly from execute to write back. In our final processor, we'll have a memory stage in between. But in this case, we have execute, lowercase e, to write back, capital W. Which capital W, because that's W, the capital part is for inputs to a stage. So we have capital W for inputs to write back, capital E for inputs to execute, capital D for inputs to decode. And similarly, the textbook's convention, which you is that this PC register would be lowercase f to capital F, because it has inputs from fetch with a lowercase f, and outputs to fetch with an uppercase f. Now, these are the textbook's conventions, but I'm going to follow them. In the slides, I think they're probably the right thing to do if you're writing HGL code, but obviously you don't have to do that. We're not checking that you use the same names. So questions on this naming convention for the signals to and from our pipeline registers? So something that will be a consequence of this convention is that when we're writing code, for example, for the decode stage here, all the signals we'll be dealing with that work with pipeline registers will start with a D. If you're writing stuff for decode and they don't start with a D, you should think, why am I doing that? There are some reasons we'll talk about later, but any value that doesn't start with a D is from a different instruction, right? Because all the decode values start with a D, if they're pipeline register values. And that's sort of why our textbook authors have chosen this convention, is so when we're looking at what happens in each stage, it's pretty clear when we're using values that must be from a different stage. Okay, so with that in mind, let's write the HCL for add queue. So I'm going to declare some pipeline register banks. So here I have the registers for a fetch to decode. So they have inputs that start with lowercase f, outputs that start with d, and I have RA and RB sorted them. That's what I've chosen. I chose different names. There are 4 bits because register indices are 4 bits. And I have a default value of regnone, which is a constant, which is the same as writing OXF. And remember, order doesn't matter, so I've chosen to write the declaration after I write the assignments to it, but you don't have to do that. And here I'm saying, okay, I'm going to set, for my fetch code, I'm going to set the fetch inputs, the inputs from fetch, I should say to be clear, from i10 bytes. And then later on, in decode, I can use those to set signals for decode. So in this case, I'm setting d.sd, which is one of the inputs to the registers between decode and execute, to be a copy of RB that I got sent from fetch. And I'm using my register file by sending RA into that register file, into source A, which means the register file is going to, for me, set output A, which I'm sending to the execute stage using a register called outline, which I've declared here. And there's some other code, presumably that sets val B, that I'm not showing. So questions on sort of why this code looks like this, how I chose to do things in this way. And I guess it might be useful to point out that, you know, this corresponds, so the FD declaration is exactly these registers, and the DE declaration I showed is exactly these registers. And generally, when we're converting sort of our unpipeline implementation to our pipeline implementation, a lot of what happens is that cases where we have some temporary value we store things in, that just becomes a value that goes into a register input or comes from a register, which makes sense because what we're doing is we're adding registers in between the operations of 2 stages. So what that turns into is one stage inputs into the register, the other stage uses the output of that register. So in this case, our fetch inputs into the registers, our decode uses the output of that rather than sort of passing the value through a single wire without a register, or a single set of wires without a register. And so if we went through this whole circuit, we'd end up with sort of these are the pipeline registers that were sent before. And we just make sure our fetch code fills in the FD register inputs, our decode logic uses those outputs and fills in the DE register inputs, and so on. Questions, setting up registers for pipeline. Okay, so I showed this example with our pipeline add processor. Let's talk about doing the entire processor. And we're not going to go into quite as much detail, well, because that's one of the homeworks, also because it's a lot. So here's our processor so far, and here's where our stages are. So we have fetch, decode, execute, but now we have memory, which we weren't showing before, because add doesn't need memory, and write back. And the first thing I'm going to do is something we all did with the add processor, which is that right now, I have some values that go from the fetch stage to the write back stage, and I need to fix those. I also have a value which goes from the execute stage to the write back stage, and I need to fix that. So remember, our rule is that the instruction should go through the stages in order. And by having these values that skip over stages, we're saying that part of the instruction goes from fetch to decode, and part of it goes from fetch to write back, and that's not okay. So we're going to split up our instruction into pieces that are happening at different times, or should be happening at different times, but aren't. And the same thing, the whole instruction should go from execute to memory and then to write back, not part of it goes from execute to write back and part of it goes execute to memory. So the way I'm going to fix that is by redrawing those signals to go through each stage, which means that for my write back stuff, made a rather bigger change of drawing them going through execute, memory, and write back. And also, I made this strategic change of that I just moved the muxes that decide what registers we write to the decode stage. I didn't have to do that. I could still have these muxes over here instead, but this is a decision I've made and our textbook makes because it's going to make some other control stuff we're going to do later on easier. In particular, we alluded to earlier that with our naive pipeline design, if we have do add R8 or 9, and then add R9 or 10, we have a problem with the value of R9. Having this information earlier is going to make it much easier to deal with that, as we'll see later on, probably this lecture, or at least maybe next week's lecture. But this is just a choice I've made because it's going to make some of the stuff we're doing later easier, but it would still work if I had this mux in any of the later stages, including write back. These muxes. Okay. And something, okay, then we're going to add pipeline registers. Just going to say between each stage, just add registers. I'm drawing this as one big register. In HTL, we'll probably declare it as a register bank with lots of pieces that are set separately. That's basically what we're doing. Now, something worth noting is that a while back, I talked about the data path versus the control path, and I mentioned I wasn't drawing the control path. And one thing we're going to come into is that, well, the control path kind of does matter, and we need to think about what happens with pipeline registers and the control path. And in particular, if we have a control path value, it needs to follow the same conventions our data path values do of going from fetch to decode to execute to memory to write back. It can't, you know, skip around. We can't have values from different instructions mixed together in a haphazard way. And we'll talk about some specific examples of that later. So questions about sort of their basic outline of our pipeline full processor. Okay, and so generally, once we've figured out sort of our overall design of our processor, and a way we can write this processor is we can just think of writing each stage separately. And when we're doing that, you know, generally what the stages are going to do is they're going to read the prior stage's outputs. So if we're running the decode stage, we're going to read the capital D things. We're going to do something with them to compute the inputs to the next stage, which are lowercase d, and we're also going to do anything with components that are part of that stage. So for example, the memory stage does things with the data memory, so that would be fine, but it shouldn't do things with like the register file, because that's not part of the memory stage. The decode stage should do stuff with the register reading signals of the register file, but it shouldn't do stuff with the register writing ones, because that's the write back stage, and so on. So generally, the rule is when you're writing code for a stage, it deals with the prior stage's outputs, which it gets from signals name based on the stage name with a capital letter, and produces the inputs for the next stage, and also deals with the components within the stage. And there will be some exceptions for this where we want to pass values between instructions, but we should know that we're doing that. So for example, if we're thinking about like implementing jump, well, jump is sending a different value to the, is sending a value to the next stage about what instruction to run. So we'd expect to have something where we're passing a value through a pipeline register, probably the PC, that doesn't sort of follow this convention in the most direct way. Okay, so mentioned about control signals. So let's talk a little about control signals with one example of a simple control signal, which is for the data memory. So you mentioned the data memory has a read-enable and write-enable signal. And in our single-cycle processor, we have some logic there which decides whether this at read-enable or write-enable based on the instruction opcode. So we get a signal we usually been calling iCode from the instruction memory, and we have something which decides how to set memread bit and memwrite bit, the read-enable and write-enable signals. And if we just leave this logic as is, well, the logic we have looks something like this. We're going to look at the iCode, which comes from the instruction memory, and decide whether we're reading or writing, for example. So that's not going to be acceptable, because if we think of this, this part here of the processor, this is part of our memory stage, and this is part of the fetch stage. Which means if we think of a program with, say, you know, let's say add mrmoveq, if we're running the mrmoveq, or add, let's say, mrmoveq in our memory stage, then our execute stage has nop, our decode stage has the second add, and our fetch stage has the first add. So our iCode would be from the add, not the mrmoveq, if we have this in our pipeline processor, if we actually did it like this. Right. Because we shouldn't use the value from fetch to decide what we're doing in memory. We need a value that was produced in fetch but passed through the pipeline register so it's from the right time. We don't want what's currently being fetched, we want what was fetched 4 cycles ago. So the way we're going to fix that is that we're going to get the value through on the pipeline register. So our pipeline registers are not just going to contain things that appear in our data path, they're going to contain things from our control path, and generally we're going to have to pass the opcode through. So we have the opcode for each stage separately, because each stage is going to have a different opcode potential. And in this case, this came from this opcode here that the memory gets is going to come from the execute stage. But the execute stage, well, it can't get the opcode from the data from the instruction memory directly because the execute and fetch stage are doing different things. So it would have gotten it from its pipeline registers from the decode stage, and the decode stage would have actually gotten it from the fetch stage. So our control logic, we need to pass the values we read in the instruction that we need for that logic all the way through the pipeline, because we can't just grab it from the instruction memory, because the instruction memory is doing something else. So even though that worked in our single cycle processor, it's not going to work anymore. We're going to have to pass those values from the fetch stage through pipeline registers. And this is part of, you know, this convention here, that, you know, we shouldn't do things where we're reading values from another stage, because that's a different instruction. And so the way we avoid that is by putting more things in our pipeline registers so we don't have to do that. So rather than checking the iCode directly from the instruction memory like our single cycle processor did, we can't do this because we're mixing fetch and memory stages and we're kind of doing something for the instruction being fetched in the memory stage. Instead, we're going to take our value from fetch and we're going to send the iCode through the pipeline registers. So when the instruction makes it to the memory stage, we can read the iCode from a register and do our control logic. in this case, figuring out whether we're reading memory or not. And to do this, generally, our pipeline registers are going to have a whole bunch of extra signals that your control logic needs. So if you're making a decision based on the I code, well, the I code came from fetch, but if you need it in the memory stage, that means you need to pass it all the way through, like this. Some questions on this idea of passing things like the I code through our pipeline registers? So that's probably most of what we'll talk about in lecture as far as implementing sort of the basic pipeline processor. So our next topic is going to be on something we'll call hazards, which are cases where sort of the basic pipeline design, you implement it basically correctly as far as like not reading things from the wrong stage, like not using a value from fetch in the memory stage without sending it through the pipeline registers. You do all that correctly, and the processor somehow produces the wrong result, or you find out, I can't actually implement this instruction. And we're going to start with an example that someone alluded to in a question, which is with what we'll call a data hazard. And we're going to use our simple add processor for that. So in this case, I'm running add R8, R9, and add R9, R8. Those are my first two instructions. And we're going to say initially that R8 contains 800, R9 contains 900. So what's going to happen is during the first stage, we're going to fetch the instruction at 0x0, this first add instruction. And then during the second stage, we're going to fetch the second instruction while we're reading registers 8 and 9 for the first instruction. During the next stage, we'll have read registers 8 and 9 to be 800 and 900. While we're reading registers 9 and 8 for the second instruction. So since we read them to be 800 and 900, we're going to be adding 800 and 900 together to get 1700. And while we're doing that, we'll have read that registers 9 and 8 are 900 and 800 for the second instruction. And here we have a problem. We read 900 because that was what was in the register file. But based on what the first instruction is about to do, that should have been 1700. Right. If we were executing these instructions one at a time, we would have stored 1700 in register 9 in time for the second instruction to read it. But because we're executing them in this sort of parallel way, that didn't happen. Sort of another way of looking at it is that sort of in our pipeline implementation, what we ended up doing is we read the registers for instructions 1 and 2, then we write the registers for instructions 1 and 2. But our specification of how add works says that first we read the registers for the first add, then we write it, then we read the registers for the second add, then we write it. We implemented something that didn't conform to how we specified our instruction set. Like our instruction set says we execute the instructions one at a time, and we aren't doing that, and we got in trouble. It turns out that you could notice this, and not just in a it's faster or slower kind of way. You could notice it because you got the wrong answer. So this problem is known as a data hazard. Data because, well, it's a problem with pipelining from having the wrong data. In this case, we have an old version of the data instead of the current. So questions on why this problem happens? Before we talk about fixes, talk about a couple different strategies for fixing this. Okay, so we have this problem where we're getting an old version of the data. How can we fix it? So one solution is we can say, well, I told you the reason it's a problem is because our instruction set says, specification says, the way add instructions work is that they store the value before we go on to the next instruction. So one way we could fix this problem is we could say, well, maybe our instruction set's wrong. We should change the ISA specification to say, add queue, it takes two values, adds them together, and three instructions later, it stores the results. You can write a new version, write our instruction set that way. And then we can say, if you're a compiler or you're writing assembly, you need to take into account that add just doesn't store it right away, it stores the three instructions later. So if you really care about that, you know, you need to add some nums, like shown. So this approach would work. You might have some complaints. You might complain, gosh, this makes writing assembly code really not intuitive. If I have to worry when I write like a move or an add instruction that I have to like figure out when does it actually take effect in my assembly code. But maybe compilers can deal with that. Maybe a more fundamental complaint you might have is that, well, I chose in this case that it takes effect, you know, in time for three instructions later because of how my pipeline was structured, how many stages I had. What if I change the number of stages? Or otherwise change my processor design, now do I need to recompile everything? And that's kind of not very nice. Either I need to recompile everything, or I'm going to have this workaround for sort of an old processor design that my compiler is implementing all the time. So probably most people don't find this solution very acceptable. I will say, however, that there have been real processors that use this approach for some hazards, where they say, we're going to just redefine how the instruction works to match what's easy to implement and make it the job of compiler and assembly writers to deal with that. I haven't actually seen it happen with this type of with hazards for add, because it turns out there's a better solution for add we'll talk about later. But probably the most common case of this is something called delay slots. There are processors where the jump instructions take effect not at the next instruction, but after the next instruction, to make the processor simpler to implement. But that means the compiler or assembly writers need to worry about, oh, when I write a jump, you know, if I don't have anything to do, I need to put a nop after it, because it's not going to take effect right away. But this is a real solution you can use. But most of the time, and I think in current processor designs, we don't find it acceptable, both because it makes it harder for the compiler and assembly writers, and because it's really awkward if you change to a new processor design where you want different types of delays in different places. You'd really like the same programs to be written right. And for that idea of having the jump take effect late, that's been a real annoyance for those platforms, is that they have this thing in their instruction set specification that's for processors that no one's building anymore. But it's still there, you still have to develop it. So another solution we might have is, you might say, well, if we're not going to have the compiler insert this sort of delay, let's have the processor do it. So you said that the compiler can deal with this by inserting nop instructions in between. Let's have the hardware do that instead. So this is going to be more work for the hardware, but basically what the hardware is going to do is, when we're fetching an instruction, we're going to check, will there be a hazard? Are we using a register that hasn't been written yet? And if so, let's not fetch a new instruction, let's just push a nop through. Let's just tell the next stage that we're running a nop instead of the current instruction, and we'll fetch the instruction later. We'll keep the PC at the same value. So this idea is called stalling. So we're going to need a little extra logic. We're going to need some logic to conditionally not change the program counter, and we're going to need some logic to, rather than sending values that would do an actual add from the fetch to the decode stage, we'll send values that say do nothing. So questions on this idea of stall? So if we were implementing stalling, the way that would work is that when we fetched the first instruction, and the processor would look at the second instruction and could detect, assuming we're doing the detection immediately, we could do it later, it turns out, we could detect at some point that, oh, this will cause a problem. This will cause a data hazard. So I'm not actually going to run the second instruction. I'm just going to send through values that won't do anything. In this case, I'm using the register none values. And I'm going to do that until I know that it's been long enough that I'm going to have the correct value of R9. So I need to have some logic that figures out when is the value of R9 going to be ready. And when I detect it's ready, I stop keeping the PC the same and sending these dummy values out. And by doing this, well, I'm wasting 2 cycles. So my processor is running slower. Previously, I was like finishing 1 instruction every cycle. Now I'm not quite doing that, but at least I'm getting the right answer. And, well, missing these 2 cycles is pretty bad, but this is something the compiler could work around. But at least when the compiler does it, we still give the right answer. The compiler could work around it, I say, because the compiler could try to reorder the instructions to not put instructions that have these problems next to each other. So questions about what our timeline with stalling looks like. Okay, so this is one way of visualizing how the instructions go through the pipeline. Another way, which might be sort of more straightforward, is we can say, okay, we have our add, our read R9 instruction goes from fetch to decode to execute to write back, from cycle 0 to 3, and our other add instruction, we kind of hold it in fetch until it's ready. And we know it's ready when, by making sure we do the decode after the write back finishes. And why do we have to do the decode after the write back finishes? Because after the write back finishes, this is when R9 is written. Is written is right there. So right after R9 is written, we can decode. Some questions? Yes? So there's one piece of terminology that's in here that we'll see later. So in order to hold the instruction in fetch while having the other stages not do something crazy, I give them a knot to do. And we call this knot a pipeline bubble. So we sent this bubble through the pipeline that goes through like a normal instruction, but it does nothing. It just holds the empty space. It's like air in our pipeline. Okay. And I guess I drew this with us holding the instruction in fetch. Another possible implementation that would be equivalent, but maybe more complicated, would be we could advance this instruction to decode and hold it in decode for a while holding the instruction behind it in fetch instead. So we could hold things in 2 stages to implement stalling. Just depend, and what we do exactly as far as, you know, whether we hold something in fetch or hold something in decode is just probably based on when do we detect that we have a problem. Right, so we could delay the detection to later, and we could still implement the strategy. We just need to hold more than one instruction in place. So that is our stalling solution. So this stalling idea, this idea of holding instructions in place and sending knots through the pipeline, it's a great solution for hazards because it always works. But it's not a great solution for hazards because, well, this is pretty expensive. That if we have to insert 2 knots for our 4-stage pipeline, and for our 5-stage pipeline, it would be 3 knots between every pair of instructions that uses the same register almost, that's going to really slow things down. We'd like to do better, and there's going to be ways to do better. So it's good to know about the stalling solution because it always works, and sometimes you might need to resort to it. But we're going to want some better solutions, which we're going to talk about mostly next time. So first, a little digression into some terminology. So I talked about these being hazards. So we had some code, we ran it through our pipeline, and we got the wrong result. So hazard is something that doesn't work in our pipeline when we do it in the most straightforward way. We have to do some extra work to make it work. Like implementing stalling would be an example of a possible extra work we could do. There's a related issue of dependency. So the reason we had a hazard is that we had two instructions that depended on each other. And these are where our potential hazards are. So every time an instruction depends on another instruction, that's a dependency. Like where an instruction writes R9 and another instruction reads R9, they depend on each other. And they could be a hazard, or they could not. Whether or not they're a hazard depends on what pipeline we're dealing with. And so we'll use both of these terms, and I want to be clear that, so dependencies cause hazards, but not all dependencies cause hazards. Some dependencies cause hazards, and whether or not they do depends on exactly what pipeline we're using. Okay, so we know about data hazards. So here I have some code, and I want to say this has some data hazards in it. And a question I have is to resolve the data hazards we have with stalling. So we're going to insert knots, we're going to delay instructions. How many cycles of stalls are needed? So how many times are we going to insert, pause an instruction? How many cycles are we going to have where we're not going to fetch a new instruction? Right, so stalls, so be explicit. This is how many cycles without fetching a new instruction. And as is given in the hint, my recommended way of solving this is to complete the diagram I've started, where I'm just saying during every cycle, what's in fetch to code execute and write back. And why do I want to do that? Well, because on this diagram I can see that, okay, R9 is available after write back of our first instruction, so I can use that diagram to figure out, okay, if something needs R9, is it going to be ready or not? I guess as another thing, step you might take in solving this is figuring out what the dependencies are. So I've drawn out our dependencies that our first instruction sets R9, which is used by the third one, and our second instruction sets R11, which is used by the fourth one. So those are the dependencies. Those are the potential places where you could have data hazards. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we need zero cycles, that there's not actually hazards? Thinks one? Okay, two? Okay, three? Four or more? Okay, so we have most people saying two, smaller number of people saying one. So let's go through here. So I've sort of drawn out my diagram a bit, and what I want to do is I want to fetch this instruction, R9 at R9, R8 next. And if I do the straightforward thing, I do the decode here. But the problem is that the value this instruction wants to read hasn't been written yet. So I can't actually usefully do the decode. So this decode is not gonna really work. So I'm going to have to delay it by a cycle. So that's going to be a stall. And that means that the instruction that follows, you know, if I'm doing the decode and throwing it away, it could be fetched here, but I can't actually have it advance beyond fetch usefully until after it finishes the decode, after the prior instruction finishes the decode. So I have my one cycle of stalling here to delay that instruction. In this case, I've written it out as if I put it in the decode stage and delay the decode. I could have also repeated the fetch stage. So equivalent way of writing this would be that I could say I do F and then there's nothing in the blockers. But either way, we're not doing the decode until cycle 4 after the write back happens. So then, I want to move on with making design. So here, now after I've done that, I can advance the add or 9 or 8, the third instruction, into execute and write back. And then I have to deal with the fourth instruction. So the fourth instruction, the earliest we can do to the decode is after the instruction before it advances to execute. So the earliest we can do to decode is cycle 5. And here, we need to read from R11. That was our dependency we were worried about. But it turns out that because the timing there, R11 has already been written, so we don't have anything to do. So it ends up we only need one cycle of stalling. So we did have two hazards, but it turns out that one cycle of stalling happened to help both of them. Because by delaying instruction 3, we also delayed instruction 4. And we just delayed instruction 4 just because, you know, even if there was no hazard with instruction 4, we still couldn't do it until after instruction 3 finished. That it's reading registers. So just because of how our pipeline works. We don't have a way of skipping one instruction ahead of the others, even if they're not that way in the program. We have to still do them in the order they appear in the program. So here's a cleaner version of basically the same thing. So we've drawn out how values are passed and the way a register file works. We have to finish the write back before we can read and decode. So questions? How I got my answer of one cycle of stalling. Surprisingly, no questions. And I think this illustrates why I really recommend making this sort of diagram rather than trying to figure it out in your head, because I at least will usually miss, oh, this helps. This changes two instructions sort of issues. Okay, so we have stolen a solution that works for solving these hazards. We haven't talked about how we'd implement an HCLRS, but we'll do that later. But there's something about Stirling which is pretty unsatisfying, which is that, well, we have to wait 2 cycles with this simple pipeline. It was going to be more with the 5-stage one. And there's actually a simpler solution. And the simpler solution we can see by looking at this timing diagram here. That in our first example of a data hazard, we had our 9 here, which we read as 900. And while we read this 900 into this pipeline register that was feeding our execute stage, another pipeline register has the correct value. We've actually computed the correct value. It's there. If only we could send it to the right instruction. But we have the value because we just computed it. We just haven't gotten it all the way through our pipeline stages and into the register file. But it is computed. It's available. We don't have to do magic to get it. We just need to figure out how to know that the value is here. So we're going to want to get the value from here on our pipeline to here. Or alternately, we could do it from here to here. That would also work. But we have the value in our pipeline. In this case, with the circles, this is just as we're storing the wrong value, we have the right value available down here. Or alternately, just before we use the wrong value with the X's, we have the right value over here. We're going to use this solution of taking the value with this first circle here and sending it up here to replace the wrong value. So basically, we're going to say, I have the right value down here on the circuit. Let's get it up there to replace the wrong value we just read. So that's exactly what we're going to do. And this idea is going to be called forwarding. We're going to forward the value which hasn't been stored yet back to the instruction that actually needs it in advance, so we can avoid stalling and still get the right value. So sort of our basic idea is going to be that when we have the old R9 here, we have our wrong 900, and we have our right R9 here, we want to add a shortcut in our circuit to get the value up. Now, we don't always want to do that because, well, most instructions aren't going to have this type of relationship. So we only want to do this sometimes. And when we only want to do something sometimes, how does that work? Well, we use a mux. So we're going to add a mux that decides whether or not we take that shortcut, we take that value that we just computed, and use it or not. Some questions on this sort of overall idea. So we're just saying, sometime we have this value we're about to write, we're going to send it to replace the value we just read, you know, to pretend that we read the correct value, even though that value hasn't been written yet. We'll look kind of confused, but I'm not seeing questions, so. Okay, so a complaint you might have is, well, this solves this particular problem, but it doesn't solve the problem in general. And one reason why is that, well, this only solves the problem when the dependency is with RA, that I'm reading using RA, register 9 that we just wrote. Couldn't I have read it using RB? And I could have. So we're going to do this again for the other case where we have it in RB. And we're going to do the same thing, but we're going to send it to replace the value we just read with source B instead of source A. And in fact, we're going to end up with a whole bunch more of these conditions, sort of these mux conditions, because it's going to turn out, what if I had add R8, R9, and not add R9, R8. So for that, I'm going to want to be able to get the value we're trying to write as a replacement for either of these. So these are going to get a bunch more complicated because we have to handle more cases like this. But generally, we're going to be able to figure out, fix this problem that we've computed a value, it's somewhere in the pipeline. We're going to figure out where it could be, and we're going to send it to replace a wrong value we just ran. And we're just going to find all the ways of doing that, and hopefully, by doing that, we'll avoid stalling almost all the time for data hazards. So we're starting with our simple case here. So let's talk about a little about, so I guess out of time, probably. Yeah, not going to do a full exercise. But what we're going to talk about next time is, well, we know about having muxes like this. How do we implement this mux? Like, how do we decide whether to take that lower path I have highlighted there or not? And sort of the preview of how we're going to do that is that we're going to use the register indices, the ones that we've passed to the register file here and are passing to our destination, to figure that out. We're going to pass those through the pipeline, and that information is going to be how we're going to know whether or not we want to use this mux or not, to mux to select the forwarded value or the normal value. That's where I'll finish up.